Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. May is National Wetlands Month, and certainly we would be very remiss if we didn't focus some attention on the wetlands here in Wisconsin, maybe a little bit across the country we can talk as well. But Zero, focus mostly on Wisconsin wetlands with our two guests today. Katie Bialfus is the Outreach Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Katie, great to have you back.
Always nice to be here. Thank you.
And Erin O'Brien back again as well. As she is the Wetland Policy Director at the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Erin, great to see you again as well.
Thanks so much.
So we'll be talking about wetlands, what's good about them, where the problems might lie. We can talk a little bit about some of the policy issues surrounding wetlands. You may have some questions about wetlands near you or maybe far away from you. Maybe wetlands you want to visit. There are also a lot of activities coming up relating to wetlands, some as early as like a week from now or about 10 days from now. So we want to let you know about those as well. If you would like to join in or when you have a question, please call us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also post a question on our Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. That's The Larry Mueller Show. At our Facebook page, and we'll handle those questions. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer, and she's always great about handling our Facebook questions and our emails as well. We're having some problems on the email side of things, I believe. No, we're not. No, Judith says go ahead. Well, you can email us then as well. Email us at talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. If you have a question, want to post it that way. Erin, what qualifies as a wetland?
Well, wetlands are actually defined by three different characteristics: the presence of hydrophytic or water-tolerant plants, soils that formed under wet conditions, so they have certain characteristics. You recognize them if you're driving through central Wisconsin, you see that deep, dark, mucky soil, and then the presence of water, although not all wetlands are wet all the time, so that clue isn't always as apparent.
And do we have all three types, Katie, in Wisconsin? We have lots of types of wetlands in Wisconsin, actually.
We do have a lot of types of wetlands. We recognize 12 wetland types. You know, wetlands don't recognize types. People need to have community classification systems. So Wisconsin Wetlands Association recognizes 12, and there are bogs and swamps and floodplain forests and lots of other different communities that people might not think about as wetlands, because typically when people think about wetlands, they think about a marsh with some water birds in there, and that's great. And we want to broaden the idea that people have in their heads of what a wetland looks like. Some of them have trees, some of them have shrubs, some of them have wildflowers and might look more like a prairie to people. But as Erin said, it depends on those three characteristics coming together in that time and place. And it's important to recognize that the water part isn't always a good factor. But just like I heard someone say, I can drive my truck on a lake in the winter doesn't mean that it's not a lake. It just means that it's frozen in the winter. And there's many wetlands where you don't have water much of the year. It doesn't mean they're not a wetland. It depends on some other of these factors, as Erin described.
Why do we need a Wisconsin Wetlands Association? What is it that you folks do, Katie, that
Well, we try
wetlands.
To provide a voice for wetlands and for the important services that they provide to our communities and for our wildlife that we value in this state and elsewhere. So we do a mix of things, both education and outreach, to help people understand what wetlands are, why they matter, and how they help our communities, and also making sure that our state's strong wetland laws are maintained as strong wetland laws and are enforced that way so that we all can have wetlands to enjoy in the future for our grandchildren.
And you talk about one of the things I think is kind of cool. You talk about wetlands workhorses.
We do.
Areas that really work hard.
Well, all
as
wetlands
part of the ecosystem.
All wetlands are wetland workhorses. All wetlands do a variety of services that help us as humans. A couple of examples of that: obviously, wildlife and fisheries habitat, which a number of us value. You know, hunting tradition in Wisconsin. But also flood attenuation. That's a big thing in the news right now. We've got huge flooding issues all up and down the Mississippi corridor and in all the tributaries because of the rains we've had this spring. And some of that, not all of that, some of that is due to the fact that we've lost a lot of our wetlands that historically would have acted like sponges and helped absorb some of those flood waters. It's not wetlands aren't the miracle solution, but they're part of what used to help those communities withstand those kinds of flooding events. And so that's a very important service that they provide. Water quality, shoreline protection, and recreational opportunities are a couple of other services that wetlands provide that we all enjoy and benefit from.
Thinking about the Mississippi, I would expect, or probably what happened was a lot of the wetlands were sort of filled in, then housing went up or buildings went up along the Mississippi, and that's that. Therein lies that problem.
That's true, and also agricultural drainage. So we've just altered the landscape in a way that we've moved the water from one place to another, and that increases the amount of water that's getting delivered and how quickly it gets delivered to our tributaries and then our main rivers. And what's happening right now on the Mississippi is that the main river's full and the water's just backing up into those tributaries and overtopping the banks of those smaller water bodies.
Somebody was wondering, it's an email, are wetlands always freshwater? I don't think so. What about those that actually are near saltwater bodies? Are they a type of transitional area as well?
Mm-hmm. Well, I grew up on the banks of the Chesapeake Bay.
And oh, cool.
I also studied coastal wetlands in Southern California. In both of those cases, they were saltwater estuaries. So those are areas where the freshwater and the saltwater are mixing. And those are very important wetland community type in coastal areas.
Do we know, just back to Wisconsin for a minute, do we know how the status of our wetlands in terms of how many acres we have in wetlands and how many we've... I know we've lost a lot of wetlands here in the state for... And we actually, you mentioned a couple of probably reasons why.
And yeah, unfortunately, we've lost almost half of our wetlands in Wisconsin. The records indicate there were 10 million acres at one point, and we're down to about 5.3. And different kinds of wetland types have been hit harder than others, depending on the nature of what's destroying them. There's a lot of wetland types that were more common in the southern part of the state that's more developed now for humans. We have fewer of those sedge meadows and fens.
Fewer sedge meadows and fens. What does a fen look like?
Well, a fen is the key factor for a fen is where the water comes from that supports it as a wetland, and that is groundwater. And so the chemistry of the system is different and therefore supports a bunch of plants that wouldn't be able to survive without that. I mean, that chemistry, they can survive and other plants aren't able to live there. And the groundwater, you know, in places it's bubbling up to the surface and that's forming the fen. And when we draw down groundwater for our own uses, that can have an impact on those fen systems. They're very sensitive or can be very sensitive to that. And you know, often where we're drawing is not next to where the fen is because the groundwater is connected underneath the soil in places we can't see, and it's hard to see all those connections sometimes.
Talking about wetlands today with our two guests, Katie Bialfus, Outreach Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, and Aaron O'Brien, who is Wetland Policy Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Questions or comments for them, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Well, let's zero in a little bit on some of the threats that we're seeing now. Aaron, what are the greatest threats to our Wisconsin wetlands?
I would say the single largest threat to wetlands in general, both in Wisconsin and nationwide, is a lack of understanding of what these systems are, how they function, and why they're important. One of the biggest challenges we have is that in the state, 75% of our wetlands are privately owned. And so the fate of wetlands is really in the hands of those people who own the property and the decisions they're making for how they want to use or enjoy that land. And so so more specifically, then, the kinds of threats we see are development pressure, drainage for ongoing or new agricultural uses, conversions of those once drained wetlands into subdivisions, so skipping, you know, the opportunity to restore wetlands. And then there's also a lot of indirect impacts. So we have, drainage or direct destruction, but then there's also just land use pressures. So delivery of pollutants running off the ag fields or the roads into wetlands and changing the chemistry of the wetland, which affects the plants community, or changing the amount of water that's entering the wetland, and either too much or too little can greatly change the quality of a wetland. So wetland degradation is a major concern from adjacent land uses.
Well, we do have some policy or some laws or things that actually address a lot of the things that you brought up, or at least try to address. For example, a loss of wetlands. What are the policies? What are the laws regarding, say, if you're going to go in Can you go in and eliminate a wetland?
Well, we have laws both under the Federal Clean Water Act as well as state legislation that does not prohibit but does discourage development in wetlands. And essentially what these laws require is that if you have a project where you want to fill a wetland, you know, pave or put a house on top of, you need to acquire a permit. And the process of getting permission for that project requires that you look at your project design and you try to design the project to avoid first and then minimize those wetland impacts. And only once you've established that you've done everything you can to avoid those impacts can you get permission to fill or a permit to fill those wetlands. And so we do see permission granted to fill wetlands, though if the systems are working properly, a lot is done up front to try to discourage the development, just to modify the design so that the wetlands are protected but the project can still proceed.
Mm-hmm. And when people create new wetlands, it can be created? They can be created?
Well, creating wetlands is difficult, but restoring wetlands is very viable. So you wouldn't be able to people try it to create a wetland in a place where one didn't historically exist. But the bigger opportunity is that we have a lot of lands that, say, those that were drained that can be restored. And there are a lot of organizations around the state and the nation that have very active wetland restoration programs. Ducks Unlimited is an example, mm-hmm. Wisconsin Waterfowl Association, and then some of our federal agencies, Fish and Wildlife Service, for example, where they're actually working with private landowners and trying to restore that wetland hydrology and those wetland plant communities and the wildlife habitat. And we see, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 acres a year in Wisconsin restored through those programs.
Oh, cool.
If I can add something to
her
comment,
Katie,
about the mitigation situation, because you hear people say, well, I promised that I would create two times as many wetlands over here if I could just destroy this one over here. But getting back to what Aaron said at the beginning about what makes a wetlands, you need to have the proper soil, you need to have the proper hydric water conditions to set it up, and then the plants will be there as well as indicators. But if you think about that, you need to have the right soil, you need to have the right water conditions. You can't create those where they don't exist, or it's very hard and requires a lot of engineering. And so I think Aaron's point that mitigation needs to be the absolute last resort, because we really have a hard time doing it. And we don't have the science, and if we don't have the water and the soil, what can you do?
Yeah, what are you going to do? Someone else wondered of an email, are there any species that rely on wetlands as their habitat that are especially in danger because of the threats to the wetlands?
Well, that's a great question. I think it's 75% of Wisconsin's wildlife species rely on wetlands at some point in their life cycle. And so things that you might not think about as being wetland dependent are, because they need some piece of water or little wetland during their reproductive phase, for example, in order for their babies to hatch out. That's an astounding statistic. An animal might not spend their whole life in a wetland, but if they need that little one part, they have to have that in order to survive. And that's why we need those.
Oh, and the estimate that I have heard is actually one-third of all of the endangered species in the state are dependent upon wetlands.
So that's pretty big. What would be an example of a species that we might not think about needing a wetland, but...
One thing that I heard about recently that I was not aware of was waterfowl need these things called ephemeral ponds. I heard a talk given by a scientist who's done a lot of work on this, Mary Linton, the creatures that are able to survive in these little ephemeral ponds because of the conditions that they create enable them to create to have enough calcium to make strong eggs, because they're eating these little teeny tiny critters that are able to inhabit these wetlands very early in the season because they're very shallow water bodies and the water warms up and these animals can get in there where other larger bodies are still frozen from the winter and they can get going early. Those wild waterfowl can come in, chow on those guys, have enough calcium to produce their eggs.
Very interesting. Katie Bielfus and Aaron O'Brien of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, our guests today. We'll take some calls. Tom and Beloit, hang in there. We'll be with you in just a second. You could join in, too, with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Larry Mueller here with my guests on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network as we talk about wetlands in Wisconsin during May, National Wetlands Month, with our two guests, Katie Bielfus and Aaron O'Brien of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Tom in Beloit, we go to you now. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry.
Good morning.
Good morning to your guests. Just a couple quick comments, first of all, about mitigation. Certainly, as your guests point out, the pressure is high on those wetlands outside of municipal areas, but most of those wetlands are significantly degraded. So in terms of replacement of values, we have certainly seen that it's possible. That's my first comment. And my second comment, it regards the Wetlands Association. I certainly was privileged to be friends with the founder, Dr. Jim Zimmerman, who believes strongly in education. And given the fact that most of our wetlands are in private ownership, I think there's a lot that can be done to educate landowners rather than just clubbing them over the head with regulations, because in most cases I think landowners can see wetlands as precious and would act as responsible stewards if they are brought along. And I'll hang up and listen to the comments. Yeah. Thank you.
Tom, thanks very much for calling. Katie Balfas, we turn to you.
Sure. Some great questions. I'm glad to have a friend of Jim Zimmerman on the line. I totally agree with you, Tom, that private landowner education is a huge part of our mission and what's really important for us to address, because we really don't want to have regulations be where the buck stops. We want the buck to stop a lot sooner than that. We want landowners to recognize what they have on their property and recognize the values that those contribute and what they can do to manage and maintain those. We have a wetland restoration handbook that we have produced that helps guide private landowners through the process if they have a property they'd like to restore. And my work is to reach out to the public and talk about wetlands and what they are and why they matter. And those that public includes private landowners.
Do you have you gone to using social media at all to reach out to these wetland owners?
Thank you for bringing that up, Larry. We're happy to launch into the social media world in honor of American Wetlands Month this month, and we have kicked off our Facebook page, Wisconsin Wetlands Association, and also a Twitter account. I've never Twittered, so I couldn't tell you about that one, but the Wisconsin Wetlands Association Facebook page is easy to find, and we would invite you to come and like us, and we'll send you a little bit of information about wetlands and the work that we're doing, if you're interested in following that.
Very cool. Let's go to Terry in Green Bay next. Hi, Terry.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for the topic. I appreciate it.
Sure.
We were involved in a hunting group that basically purchased a couple hundred acres up in Juneau County, and we had contacted the DNR to put in some, restoring some wetlands. There had been some diking and ditching done to drain some of the property. So we happened to be fortunate to get a Manny Johnson from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife to come down from the Nisida Wildlife Refuge. And he said basically he would recommend for duck population for hatching, is to create scrapes, versus ponds. And my question specifically is can a private landowner create small scrapes to, detain water on the property without having permits?
Oh, okay. Erin, do you want to take that?
Sure. It's always a good idea to check in with those that manage those regulatory programs, because you don't want to inadvertently make an expensive mistake and run afoul of the law. The good news is if your club is working or a private landowner wants to do wetland restoration, there are a lot of agencies and organizations out there that have the expertise to guide you through that process and they have the experience to make some judgment calls about when you need to apply for permits. Typically, permits are required for wetland restoration because the work is often happening in areas that have some residual wetlands, and so they want to make sure the projects are designed to be enhancements and not inadvertently cause problems. But the good news is actually last year some new legislation passed that made that permit process, at least for the federal agencies that have wetland restoration programs, the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Natural Resources Conservation Service, that is expediting the permit review process for those agencies. And a lot of the private lands restoration work that's happening goes through those agencies or in partnership with those agencies. So we are hopeful that that means less red tape for landowners in the long run and more wetland restoration projects on the ground.
So there you go. Thanks, Terry.
Can you assist me in trying to identify who those agencies, which particular agency we would contact within Juneau County, take the next step? Because we went to the DNR, and they said, if you're going to do ponds, there's permits required. But
Yeah, well, ponds are, you know, ponds are a little different than scrapes, and ponds get a little more complicated from a regulatory perspective. But so it sounds like you've already talked to the Department of Natural Resources, and you've got the Fish and Wildlife Service involved, and those are really the two main agencies that I think would help you through the process. So I'm not.
If they're it sounds like the DNR was saying you don't need a permit.
Well, U.S. Fish and Wildlife indicated that he didn't think we'd need permits on private land to create small scrapes. But, you know, to get the water to get into the scrapes, you know, some of the ditching that had been done to remove the water off the farmland, you know, to get to the river, you know, would need to be, you know, plugged up. But my understanding is a reversal or restoration, that's part of that process.
Yeah, I don't know if you've talked to who you've talked to with the Department of Natural Resources, but there will be a person in Juneau County that has the title Water Management Specialist, and they would be the right contact for you to make an inquiry to describe what your objectives are and to get information from them about what permits you need and what that process is going to look like.
At the county level?
Well, you need to search on DNR's website for water management specialists. Because they're so short-staffed, they may have one person that's covering several counties, but you can search by county to find the contact for your community.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Rusty in Madison, we're on to you now. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I own a wetlands, and my wife and I are in a bit of a dispute as to what to call it. This has been going on for some time. What it is, there's 30 acres there, and about 20 of it is all the drainage area of the Bell Fountain Creek. And the previous owner had scooped out a pond by filling around it, you know, scooping it out and making a berm around the perimeter of a pond. And there's all manner of things that live in there, turtles, fish, frogs. But, of course, it is spring-fed, so I call it a fen. Now, is it a fen or is it something else?
Rusty, I wish this was a question we could answer for you, but it's going to be one of those things where you need to have someone come out and take a look at it. And it sounds like because it's an altered system, you know, there's been involvement with it in a number of different ways. The ways that humans alter systems sometimes makes it hard to then put it back in a natural area category, if that makes sense. Mostly, I'd encourage you to enjoy what's there, and if there are aspects of the wetland that you're concerned about, for example, if there's invasive species coming in, then we can certainly get you some tools or connect you with some folks to talk about managing that beautiful area. I'm not sure if it matters what it's called, as long as it's working right and it's giving you pleasure.
Well, it is working out, but what exactly is a fen besides being spring fed?
Okay.
It's groundwater fed, not necessarily surface spring water. And it's also a very technical category. I'm not sure I feel scientifically qualified to answer that question.
Well, I don't think a fen would necessarily be characterized with open water, though. So it sounds like you have a pond or an open water marsh would be probably the best guesses without laying eyes on it.
Uh huh.
Is it ringed by cattails?
No, there's no cattails yet.
Right.
It's it is it's got you know, all manner of aquatic plants in there. It's quite weedy at times. I rake them out every now and then just so I can swim in an area. But it is full of turtles and just everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, one resource we do offer is a wetland directory. It's a voluntarily populated directory on our website where wetland professionals from around the state can enter their contact information and their areas of expertise and geographic work area. So if it's something you really would like to have someone come take a look at, that's one resource we offer that you can check out our website, which is wisconsinwetlands.org, and then take a look at the wetland directory to try and connect with a person who might be able to come out and look at the property.
And you might even be able to take some digital photos. Mm-hmm. If you took a bunch of digital photos and explained a little background on it, just as you've explained it here, Rusty, I'll bet there'd be some people who would take a look at it and say, if it was me and I'm one betting side or the other here between the husband or wife, I'm going to go with him or her, you know? Yeah. So
the wife is always right, Larry. Come on. Just kidding.
So you might consider that as well, Rusty.
Okay, so I guess the debate rages on.
Yeah, but get some digital photos, send them in, and see what happens. Actually, you could post a few on the Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show, okay. Post a few, and we'll see. We'll get Katie and Aaron to take a look at them, and maybe Scott Craven or some other people, and see if we can't come up with an answer for you. So send some photos. Go to the Larry Mueller Show and post them on the Facebook page. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in as well at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. We have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. Gary from Summers emailed us, wonders if there's an agricultural field that has standing water part of the year, whether this is considered a wetland. And you see that.
You do see that, and this is a hard year to make that guess because there's a lot of water on the landscape in places that it might not sort of quote-unquote normally be. But again, there are, as Aaron pointed out earlier, there's a lot of agriculture that's associated with historic drainage or and even current drainage with ditches or tiles. And so that you might have something, if it's an agricultural property with standing water, again, it needs to have the soils. And so that if in the wetland restoration handbook that we have walks landowners through the process of trying to figure out what you've got about taking soil cores and actually getting out there and taking a deep look.
And actually, if I may add to that, for farmers, there are exemptions for farmers from state and federal regulatory requirements. Mm. And so the question of whether that area, maybe some of it has reverted back to a viable wetland, doesn't necessarily mean that the farmer couldn't continue ongoing agricultural operations on that property. If it was, you know, if it has been in agricultural production for some time, it might just mean that it's not a very productive area for that farmer, but it doesn't mean that it's illegal in any way for them to be, you know, planting crops or trying to get a harvest off of that land.
Yeah, and on the other hand, I know driving around, there are certain places that I see every single year there's agricultural land, cornfield or whatever, that is underwater, and it's that same area every year, and you wonder why. You wonder if maybe the person would be further ahead just to give up on that. I don't know. Aaron, what do you think?
Well, you know, there are incentives for farmers to maximize the extent of land in production, whether it's through crop insurance programs that will guarantee a return on the land, whether the crop succeeds or not. In the state of Wisconsin, there are also property tax incentives for having that land in agricultural production. So where a landowner might not be getting a profit off of what they're planting every year, they receive agricultural tax property tax benefits, so it's to their benefit to plant and roll the dice. If they restore it to a wetland, the land would be reclassified and they'd have a higher tax burden.
Okay. Brad in Spring Grove, Illinois, we're on to you now. Hi, Brad.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just caught the tail end of the conversation and there was a conversation about whether it was a fen or not.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to throw in my comments that actually, the definition of a fen is based on the calcifile plants that would be present there, and they would be plants that would be well adapted to a very high pH environment, and that high pH makes it very difficult for plants to gather nutrients, so there's very few plants that can grow under those very high pH soils. And it's really based also on the uninterrupted flow of groundwater. So those combination of the chemistry as well as the hydrology would actually be the definition of the fen.
That makes sense.
Thank you for articulating that so much better than I did, Brad. I really appreciate that.
Well, and the other thing that's interesting about that is it's one of the reasons, you know, when we talk about laws that protect wetlands and this requirement to avoid and minimize wetland impacts, the laws also discourage development in areas that are, you know, regionally or locally rare. And a fen is a good example where it may not, you know, in some areas they may not be as rare as in others, but we don't really know how to restore them because of all those really particular requirements. So the level of scrutiny on a project that would have an impact to a fen will necessarily be higher than it might be for a, you know, a more common wetland type or a more easily restorable wetland type.
Yeah.
Right, because it's very difficult to restore not only the hydrology or, like I say, the uninterrupted flow of that groundwater, but also to
pH
to change it, to make sure that the pH is that high pH that, you know, only calms lobelia or grass crinasus. There's a set of about five or six species of plants that, if they're present, then that would be classified as a fen because of their presence.
So. Oh. Thank you, Brad.
Okay.
Yeah, appreciate your comments very much. You did a nice job of explaining that for us. We have John in Sparta who has a comment or question. John, hi to you.
Hi there. Cranberry growers, about 80% to 90% of the state have to follow regulations. The cranberry growers seem to have carte blanche when it comes to wetlands. They can develop bogs as long as they make a pond, fence the whole area. The taxpayers pay for the fence or the majority of the fence and keep all wildlife off their property. And I guess a particular case of my brother-in-law has a road that washed out in the last year, and to the left side of the road is a wet, swampy area. He went to ask, because there's a creek on the right side of the road, not navigable. It's basically just a spring water that sedimented full, so now the creek runs in the road. He cannot fix the road. They came and looked at it. This is the only access he has to about four farm fields, and it's only been in his father ran the farm for 70 years, and now he can't. He's got to go a completely different route to get to his road because of he let somebody look at it, and now he can't put the road back in.
No.
But I guess that's it becomes a little discouraging when a particular group has preference in the state, and long time are actually permanent residents who are taxpayers get a different look at their problems.
John, thanks for calling, and I want to turn back to Aaron for a comment. Aaron?
Yeah, well, I can certainly appreciate your concern. I think that some of what John said is a little different than my understanding of how the cranberry industry is regulated, at least as it pertains to wetlands. They do have some more allowances than general landowners, and it's based on the constraints of the industry. So I mentioned this process of doing an alternatives analysis, for example, to build new projects in wetlands. If you're an existing cranberry operation, there are some allowances that would allow you to expand an existing operation into wetlands without some of the more stringent review. But if it was a new project, they'd be subject to the very same rules as everybody else. And this is all driven by federal law. And so, in fact, we don't see very many new bogs going in to new wetland areas in the state of Wisconsin. Most of them, I believe, are now being built in upland areas. There are other, concerns related to water diversions, and I can't comment on the taxpayer subsidies for fences because I don't know anything about that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, John, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Ann a chance to get involved, too. Ann in Sheldon, Wisconsin. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Okay, we have some land that's in wetlands, and some years ago it was fenced off. And the fencing was kind of a poor job they'd done, and all the corner posts and everything have come out. Is there any funding out there available to re-fence this so our cattle don't get in there?
Well, Ann, that's a very good question, and I'm afraid we're both looking quizzically at one another, and I don't know if that... if we know of a source for that.
Yeah, I would encourage you to talk to your county conservationist or the district conservationist. It sounds like maybe there'd be some, you might be able to find some support if it's based on, conservation practices where you might be trying to keep the cows in or out of a certain area. But this is outside of our area of expertise, so I would call your county.
So a county conservation service?
Every county has a county conservationist their job is working with farmers to help with soil erosion control and other conservation practices. So that person will have the expertise about both good techniques and potential funding sources.
Okay. There you go. Thank you for calling in. Charles and Holcomb, on to you. Hi, Charles.
Hi. I hope you folks can help me.
All right. Give it. What have you got?
Well, I've got about 13 acres of wetland, 11 of which is a peat bog. and I have a start of a pretty good invasion of purple loosestrife. Where can I get some help to get rid of it?
That is a pesky plant. And invasive species, as we were talking earlier in the program, is another big group of threats to wetlands, both plants and animals. We have the emerald ash borer now as well, threatening wooded wetlands in Wisconsin and in the Midwest. So purple loosestrife, there is a program that's through the UW Extension and Wisconsin DNR that is talking about purple loosestrife control and working with groups on that. There is a biocontrol agent or a couple of agents. There's some beetles that exclusive that have been tested over a number of years that they are exclusively feed on the purple loosestrife. And so in some cases, that is a technique other people will use. Herbicide, it depends on what you have growing there that you're obviously, you don't want to use herbicides if there's a bunch of really lovely plants there because there's not one herbicide that kills just purple loosestrife. You know, they're more general than that. So I would, if you want to contact our office, you can send me an email at programs@wisconsinwetlands.org, and I can connect you with that program. If you don't have success, just Googling the information about purple loosestrife at the UW Extension.
All right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, the insect control, the biological control has been pretty effective, I think, in some areas.
One challenge is there are places in the state where the purple loosestrife has been very effectively controlled, and unfortunately, Phragmites, the giant reed grass, has come in to fill the spaces that were evacuated when the purple loosestrife was removed or diminished. So invasive species are a very, very complicated problem and very challenging because there is no good way to solve it. The unfortunate thing is often invasive species are a sign. It's like a scab on the landscape. You get a scab when you have an injury and your body is trying to heal it. The invasive species are sort of the scab, and once they're in, it's very hard to get rid of them.
Jeannie and Jefferson, your turn. Hi.
Hi. I went to a presentation recently that the DNR were there, and they were showing us some GIS-type mapping that they did when the FEMA people were in the area because of the 2008 floods.
Uh-huh.
And it was so interesting because what they did is they were overlaying maps that they had of wetlands with maps that where the flooding was. And as water was draining off, they were able to see areas that they think would be good for recovering wetlands because they're able to cite things and put emphasis by how much water that area was holding based on how it was draining off the land from the floods. And I wanted to see if the guests knew anything more about what the DNR is doing related to things like that.
Okay.
I can talk just a little bit about this. You know, there are a lot of opportunities for helping communities improve their resilience to severe weather events and flooding by restoring natural hydrology to floodplains and restoring wetlands for their water storage capacity. One really cool project I'm aware of that the DNR has done, it was part of the TMDL development in the Rock River Basin, and that's a fancy acronym for a process for creating a plan to improve water quality when there are impaired waters identified as impaired under the Clean Water Act. And what they did, and this was also using GIS technology, is that they've mapped not only where the wetlands are in the basin, but where what they're calling potentially restorable wetlands are. And so these are areas that had historically had either wetlands or at least hydric soils that have not yet been inalterably impacted by development. And then that information can be used sort of as a decision support tool for making determinations of where we could be putting wetlands back on the landscape. Now there are additional studies and models that need to be used to determine where that could happen to the best effect. But it's a really important, I think, field of study and opportunity for communities to pursue to find out where there are restorable wetlands, and then you know, make a triage decisions in terms of where they spend and where they choose to mm-hmm. restore.
Very cool.
Yeah.
With that, we are out of time. And here we got all these events coming up. I know there's Wisconsin Wetlands Association Field Trip Series. I know there's an Upper Mississippi River Exploration. There's a Wetland Water Bugs, Horican Marsh Naturalist Program in Dodge County. If you go to the Wisconsin Wetlands Association website, so just go, if you put in Wisconsin Wetlands Association, it's going to pop up.
WisconsinWetlands.org, and we have both a field trip page and a calendar of events that features not only our own events, but events of our partners across the state that'll help you learn more about wetlands and celebrate American Wetlands Month.
Perfect. Katie, Aaron, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Always Thanks for having us.
Katie Bialfus, Outreach Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Aaron O'Brien is the Wetland Policy Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. We will obviously, we'll have them back. We'll do this again. We're staying kind of in the water a little bit. We're turning our attention to Wisconsin fishing. The season opened statewide this past weekend. Lots of people out on the water. Gary Engberg, professional angler and fishing guide, an avid conservationist and sportsman, with us next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.